music of Charles Bradley, and the song is The World, there are brackets, is going up in flames. Well, there's your 2020 zeitgeist for you. If you've been feeling a little down in the dumps, well, no wonder it has been the year for it. Maybe in the course of these months, if not before, maybe you've asked some big but possibly unanswerable questions, not only of yourself but of the world in which you live. And that's the territory for this conversation. It's a sense of place. And we will shortly be taken to Crete by author Sarah Wilson, a journalist, author of several books, the latest, This One Wild and Precious Life. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
Before we go to Crete, tell us about that song.
I actually find it a very uplifting song. I think it's because I've written a book that's taken me down into the guts of where we are at with life in 2020. And this one, I feel some solidarity from Charles Bradley, who died a few years ago. His voice is absolutely beautiful. And this song is really, it sort of sums up where we're at, not just the fact that we're going up in flames with climate change and the bushfires, which were all happening when I was finishing my book, but also this line, and nobody want to take the blame. And I think that that's the thing that's going on here. I feel that the big challenge for humanity at the moment is to get really adult, to stop being so adolescent with what's going on, and to take responsibility. And that's the challenge we face.
Let's go to your place, which is Crete, and well, tell us the story there, because it's a complex one and it's an emotionally turbulent one.
Yeah. So in my book, I actually hike around the world in the footsteps of different philosophers and characters throughout history and poets. Yeah, as you do. Well, I mean, I have to say that I didn't have a mortgage in the eastern suburbs of Sydney at the same time. I lived very, very nomadically and minimally out of one bag, actually. It got down to 15 kilos for 8 years.
Bravo.
It's the way that I like to live life. It's very, very light. But it so happened I found myself on the island of Crete, halfway through the writing of this most recent book. And look, the Greek people and the Greek landscape calls me, and it always has. I have gone back to Greece over and over again. And, I was in Crete, it was sort of almost the penultimate chapter in my motherhood journey. I'm in my mid to late 40s now, and I was 44 when I arrived in Crete. And I was there to get the sperm of a 21-year-old Danish poet inserted into me in the hope that I would give birth. So
This is the traditional reason, of course, for visiting Crete.
I find most people do find themselves in Crete for this reason, with a vial of Danish sperm. I navigated all the intricate laws and prohibitions presented to women in their 40s when they're trying to get pregnant without a partner. And I found this perfect combination of situations. And so I was there at a clinic. The clinics are particularly good there, and they have absolutely no bias against what your marital status might be or your life situation might be. And so they're very, very generous, and gosh, do they love a mother in Greece. So, look, I did get pregnant. It was just a straight insemination, not IVF. I was very fortunate, and I go on a journey, and part of the journey of this book is, you know, sort of ending up in Slovenia, then Slovakia, and then realising I don't have an obstetrician, and then ending back in Crete because my doctor rang me and said, hey, our dear Sarah, please come back and let us look after you until you can fly home. I ended up losing that baby. She tied herself in a knot, the umbilical cord, at the 3-month mark. And so it was very, very sad. But Crete, the land, the people, this kind of legacy of radical kindness to strangers held me. And it was a place where I was able to process the grief of that experience, because I knew it would be the last time. I knew it was really the last chance. And as you know, I think you may have read the chapter where I head off into the mountains.
Yep.
And I wail out my grief. And I was reading the poetry of David White, a wonderful Irish poet, and he talks about grief as this, it's like you fall into grief, much like you fall into love. And it's a sense of falling towards something. But in the case of grief, you're falling towards something that has now disappeared, and you fall searching for it, and you fall through one floor, then another and another. And eventually you do land, and you land in the spot where that thing or that person that you are lacking used to be, and what holds you is yourself. I did that by the day after losing the baby, heading off into the mountains, the White Mountains, which are historically very rugged. Anyone who's read Zorba the Greek knows that it was set there. It holds a very special place in my heart because it held me, and it's held me over and over again. And this notion of philotimos is something that the Greeks have taught me, and it's definitely something that I come back to over and over again, and it's part of growing up.
Tell me more about the hiking, because this is, of course, at the core of this book. And here we have a way, I always think about the outdoors, about walking. It's a way of abruptly escaping the self in a way, but at the same time going deeper into the self, but using the exterior as part of that examination.
Yeah, that's a really lovely way of putting it. I've always hiked. I've hiked to modulate my anxiety. I have bipolar, and I've grappled with that. I've modulated it. I've managed it. I've thrived with it for all of my adult life and you know, really gone down deep to understand it better. And so hiking has always been something I've intuitively done to manage it. And in this most recent book, I really wanted to look at how it could actually help us from managing that inward journey, but also going outwards again, because I believe that life is calling us outwards. We've been a very insular sort of individualistic culture where self-help and all the work that we do, hashtag or quote unquote work that we do is self-work. It's been very much about looking after ourselves. And I think we have hit a point in history where we need to go outwards. Life, the planet, other people, humanity, it's calling us outwards. I find that walking in nature brings us to a place where we can think most clearly. And if there's one thing that we suffer from in the current era, it's a real struggle to be able to find the space, but also the part of our brain that can think clearly, because we're so bombarded with fake news and truth decay and just, you know, our attention is fragmented.
Yeah. All that stuff you talk about, that sort of wild hecticness of the modern, and this is very much a part of it, the modern sort of information world, I mean, you're very much a creature of that. I mean, your public self is based around the internet and you know, the words you put out there on it. How does that sort of reconcile that sort of internet life and also seeing the downsides of that?
Yeah, well, I very much live in that vortex of trying to take the good side of it all, and there is goodness. You know, Jonathan, I know of your pain, outrage, incredibly erudite thoughts via social media.
that thought I had once, yes.
And then, of course, there's that distraction. I mean, the algorithms, we are aware, many of us are aware, that we live in a distraction economy where there are forces at play trying to drag our attention away from discerning, mindful thinking.
Distraction being the business model of many large enterprises. I mean, that's what they do.
Exactly, exactly. The bread and the circuses of 2020. Look, I struggle with it. Struggle is good, though, because it's in the struggle that you actually arrive at a spot that's going to work for you. For me personally, it is very much about putting up guardrails. And I talk about this in the book as well. A big part of our disconnect that we feel and the fragmentation that we're experiencing comes about because we live in a culture where we are devoid of the moral guardrails that used to keep us on the straight and narrow, whether they be trade unions, HR departments that would ensure that we didn't work 24/7, you know, being constantly available on our phones, even the church, right? Yep. They ordained a Sabbath. And when I was growing up, and Jonathan, I suspect you may recall this, even half of Saturday was sort of shut off from being distracted by the distraction economy.
All the shops were shut.
Oh, they were all shut, you know. The lawnmower started about midday and that was it, you know. And so we did have these guardrails. Ironically, over in Silicon Valley, the big tech heads are into what they call dopamine fasting. And this is literally putting up guardrails to their technological use, both hourly and then also daily, weekly, and then annually. So there's these people and these practices and these ways of doing it. They should know. There's irony, right? I've read countless articles about the big tech heads, the CEOs of these companies, who actually don't buy technology for their children and send their kids to science school where they play with wooden blocks, you know.
There's lessons in this for us. I mean,
yes.
The quest for knowledge and all of this, and I mean, it is inevitable that we sort of take wrong turns. I mean, have you ever found yourself on the wrong path and sort of had to walk that back? And that's such a difficult thing to do publicly.
Yeah, very often. And I think the best thing that we can do is actually be humble and apologetic and own any mistakes that we make publicly. Yep. And look, it's a really funny thing. I'm a trained journalist. So we were trained in this idea of you've got to be care and responsibility. When you have a voice out there in a public realm, there's a responsibility that comes with that. You know, part of the responsibility, and unfortunately it's not indoctrinated into the culture of social media, is that if you get something wrong, own it and share it with the community and make sure that you don't steer people down the wrong path. So, you know, I mean, I had a business that was encouraging people to quit sugar, and at times the science changed. You know, it's an emerging science, nutritional science. And I, you know, there was some stuff that I was sharing, and I had to do a big campaign to go, look, this has been updated. I've repositioned my thinking based on the latest science, and this is what you need to know. But equally, look, I feel that the biggest thing that we are missing in our culture, and the biggest and probably the simplest way forward in terms of a salve, is that we need to have more meaningful conversations around everything that we're doing.
Well, conversations being sort of the critical word rather than confrontations, perhaps, which is the way things so often turn out to be.
Yeah, that's right. And so when I've had various trolls over time, and with all this QAnon stuff that's happening at the moment, the conspiracy theorists, I've got a lot of them reaching out to me and contacting me. And these are not bots, you know. These are everyday people that I sort of loosely know their Instagram or their Facebook account, you know.
But that's interesting, because the Venn diagrams of people vulnerable to those sorts of conspiracy theory and the Venn diagram of people who are looking for meaning in their life have big overlaps.
Yes, because behind these alt-right conspiracy theorists and behind this, the wellness spiritual realm operators, and as you say, there's this sort of overlap that's happened where they're all meeting, this QAnon, children being hidden under tunnels, you know, the Clintons are all in some kind of sex trafficking gang together. They're all meeting, converging in this space, and it would be sort of really, I mean, it is worrying, but behind it is a desire for truth and also an absolute confusion as to what the hell's going on in the world and who to believe. And also fueled by a bigger chasm, a growing chasm between the haves and have-nots. And so a lot of these conspiracy theories are directed at the elites of Hollywood, the elites of politics, the elites of the tech worlds. And that's where we're all feeling very we're feeling disconnected from these so-called elites. And so, you know, conspiracy theories develop at times like this, in times of fear. And it's no coincidence that a lot of it is emanating from Melbourne, and it emanated in the last couple of weeks, you know, because this is where the fear is at, you know. And Jonathan, you'd know this, you know, I think Victorians very much feel left out. When we were all in it together, there was this solidarity, right? Yep. You know, we were all in it together fighting this COVID virus. When you suddenly have one state separated from the rest, that creates this us versus them mentality, and it cranks up the fear, and then the conspiracy theories take hold.
Well, let's hope we can all be together again soon. And it certainly has that feeling. Sarah, thank you. It's a wonderful journey. And yes, that thing of being out in the world on your own two feet, it's such a settling experience. Thank you for bringing a bit of that to us.
My pleasure, and hope to see you soon when we can cross borders.
It'll happen. Sarah Wilson, journalist and author. New book is called This One Wild and Precious Life. You can find that in shops or, of course, at your local library. And this is Blueprint.